Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Glad to have you with us on this Tuesday. The deadline to formally object to Detroit's bankruptcy filing has come and gone. Yesterday was the deadline to file challenges to the city's eligibility for Chapter 9 protection. On today's program, we look at the objections and figure out where things go from here. And then the Amish community in North America. It has grown 20% over the past 5 years. We explore what's behind the growth later in the hour. But first, after nearly 5 years, the city of Pontiac's financial emergency is officially resolved. Emergency manager Lou Schimmel resigned yesterday, although the state will still have a very heavy hand in the city's finances. A transition advisory board appointed by Governor Snyder and including Lou Schimmel will have to approve all major budget decisions. Joining us again on Stateside is Lou Schimmel. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you very much.
So first off, let's talk a little bit about where you think Pontiac is today and why you felt comfortable saying, all right, I'm laying it down, I'm leaving office as emergency manager.
Well, when I started the job 2 years ago, I wasn't sure this day would ever come. But the questions that were all being asked at that time were, should we go bankrupt or should we borrow more money? And my whole approach, of course, was quite different than that. I claimed that the thing that needed to happen first was to resolve all of the mismanagement in Pontiac and do all the right things in putting together a streamlined, efficient government. And after all of those things were done, then you would ask those questions and see where you were at. And after 2 years of mass rearranging the city and contracting out nearly every service in the town and reducing the debt from $115 million down to $28 million and reducing the annual expenses from $57 million 6 years ago down to $30 million today, it became clear as we got towards the end of all of that that we actually could save the city from going bankrupt or for the need for borrowing more money. That's why I decided now that I've balanced the budget and it's a real fix and they can live with better services than they've ever had for $30 million a year. I decided to write a letter to the governor and say it was fixed and leave.
Mr. Schimmel, what do you say to residents of Pontiac who say, well, okay, he's fixed the financial problems, but at what cost? With so many changes and so much cutting to the bone, is it still Pontiac?
It most definitely is still Pontiac. I don't think that you determine a city by what it runs itself. It's, you determine what a city is how efficiently it delivers services. The fact that it isn't delivered by Pontiac departments but outside contractors, to me, doesn't mean that the city of Pontiac is gone. I get irritated when I hear about people talking about their jewels. The city jewels are gone. Well, the city jewels aren't worth a thing if they're mismanaged, poorly run. Take for example, Belle Isle in Detroit. Belle Isle is a jewel only if somebody runs it right. The fact that the city of Detroit owns it and mismanages it, to me, it's no longer a jewel. So I guess I have a different approach to how I look at those kinds of questions.
We're speaking with Lou Schimmel, who has resigned as Pontiac's emergency manager. He will be part of a transition advisory board that will have to approve all major budget decisions. And let's talk about this board. What will it do? What will be your responsibilities?
Well, the board's responsibility is oversight, but it's a strong oversight, no question about it. After all, we've spent a lot of time, a lot of money, and a lot of effort getting Pontiac to where it is now. In previous cities that I was in when we were operating under different acts, I simply walked out and the cities fell back to their old ways, and we're in trouble again. We want to make sure that doesn't happen in Pontiac, so the governor has appointed and the new law provides for a transition board so that you just don't go from the kind of operation I've been running to just dropping it the day you leave. So this transition board will oversee good practices that need to stay in place. It makes sure that present employees who are extremely qualified that I brought in stay in place. They can't get fired the next day. It makes sure that city council members don't involve themselves in the day-to-day operation of the city, but they let the contractors do their work, and all sorts of good practices of that type will remain because of the transition board. Now, as things change, the mayor and council can bring to the transition board changes they'd like to make, but they're going to have to budgetarily make sense in order to make those kinds of changes.
So even as the mayor and the city council come back, assume their former roles effective on Monday, they're doing it with kind of you there on their shoulder. Would a good comparison be when a patient comes out of intensive care and goes into what's called the step-down unit?
I think that's a great description of what's happening right now. And this transition board will last either a long time or a short time, depending on the behavior and cooperation of the mayor and council. If the mayor and council do a good job, show they can run the city, the transition board will recommend that they take the next step and disappear. If they squabble, fight, and make bad decisions and go back to their old practices, the transition board will be around for a long time.
What do you see, Lou, for the future as you look across the state of Michigan and Michigan's cities? Do you see financial and structural problems all around the state?
Well, no, I don't. We have the usual cities that seem to always be in trouble. But, you know, I think what I did in Pontiac and what I'm so proud of is the fact that I believe even the well-run cities need to look at the kinds of things we did in Pontiac for saving money. I don't see more than the several municipalities that we know about already. I see others going there because they can take the same avenue I took, same road I took, in terms of substantially reducing the costs of running government and still deliver great services by making several of the moves I made. You got to right-size labor contracts. You got to look at the options of using all of the specialists that can deliver services far cheaper than you can do it yourself. So I think there's plenty of room for municipalities still within their budgets to make things work without going into bankruptcy or the great need for more funds.
For these kind of chronically plagued communities with financial problems that we've all heard in the news, and as you say, we know the names well, do you believe the state itself is doing enough to help these communities?
Well, I do. I think the problem here that everybody likes to ignore, I don't say everybody, but a lot of people like to ignore, is like I started out our conversation. As we talk about these communities and we listen to what they're saying, and what they're saying is, we want to continue to mismanage like we always have. Just send us more money. We don't want anything to do with the state of Michigan except send us more money so that we can continue to mismanage. And that's what I say has to stop. We have to educate these communities that that isn't the route to fiscal stabilization. The route is clean up your own act first, run your city properly, and then you won't have all these kinds of problems that you're dealing with today.
But the point should be made that revenue sharing has been cut to these to cities across Michigan.
I understand that. Revenue sharing has been cut, but a lot of us have to do with less than we had before. And I believe there's still plenty of money to run, for example, the city of Detroit, Pontiac, Flint, or any place else, if you clean up the sins of the past.
Lou Schimmel, the now former emergency manager of the city of Pontiac. Thanks for talking with us today on Stateside.
You're welcome.
He was one of America's most prolific crime writers. Elmore Leonard died in the Detroit area this morning. He was 87. As Michigan Radio's Kate Wells reports, Leonard's writing was frequently made into movies, including Out of Sight, Get Shorty, 310 to Yuma, and the TV hit Justified.
Elmore Leonard was well into his 46th novel when he suffered a stroke and was hospitalized earlier this summer. You know his stuff even if you've never read one of his fierce, funny, no-frills stories. His work gave us smart, sexy film noir like Out of Sight, and he brought new life to the classic Western with the character of Raylan in Justified.
30 seconds.
In front of all these people, you're going to pull out a gun and you're going to shoot an unarmed man?
20 seconds.
So what are you going to do?
10.
Leonard started out writing westerns in the 50s before moving on to crime writing, but what he always kept was sparse, smart dialogue. His characters swagger more than they talk, but when they do, it's memorable. Plus, the setting for his stories, whether it's L.A. or Harlan County, they're always a character in and of themselves. And it's hard not to think that Leonard might have learned a little bit about that in his hometown. He grew up largely in Detroit and wrote several times about the city.
I've lived here since 1934. I've used Detroit because I live here, because I remember parts of it that were important in the past, and I know the city. But Detroit is perfect for me.
Leonard was also known for his 10 rules of writing. Number 10, try to leave out the parts that people skip. For Stateside, I'm Kate Wells.
Still to come, why some Amish families are deciding to move from family farms to small businesses. That's coming up next here on Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. When you think of the Amish, what comes to mind? Horses, buggies, long dresses and bonnets, long beards, no electricity? Well, yes, there is all of that. But there is so much more to the Amish in America and here in Michigan, from St. Joseph, Hillsdale, and Branch counties to the south to Mackinac County in the Upper Peninsula. The Amish population reaches nearly 11,000. We wanted to learn more about the Amish, especially what the rest of us might learn from them. Consider this. How does a one-room Amish schoolhouse going only to eighth grade with only a battery-powered clock in the way of technology, how do these schools turn out highly successful entrepreneurs, some of whose firms gross annual sales in the million-dollar range? I'm joined by Gertrude Enders Huntington, retired lecturer from the University of Michigan. She's the co-author of Amish Children, Education in the Family, School, and Community. And she joins us from her home in Kennett Square, Pennsylvania. And we're also joined by Steve Nolte, professor of history at Goshen College in Indiana. He's the co-author of The Amish. It was the companion book to the American Experience documentary on PBS. Welcome to both of you. Trudy, when you were a grad student at Yale in the 1950s, you chose to do your dissertation on an Ohio Amish community. Why were you drawn to them?
Because everybody else was studying we're studying sort of our plundered planet, everything that people were doing wrong with the environment. And here were the Amish who were moving in often to farms that had been really worn down and building up the soil and having a positive effect on their environment. So I wanted to study how they did it and, more importantly, why they did that when their neighbors were acting differently.
And what was the reaction of your professors when you said, all right, I'm going to study the Amish?
Well, they were in favor because they knew they were going to die out, and they thought it'd be nice if I would document them before they died out. There were at the time about 30,000 Amish, and now they're about 280,000, so they didn't die out very well.
So clearly those professors were wrong. Steve Nolte, why has the Amish community grown as we've moved into the 21st century when we see doubling in number every 18 to 20 years? What's behind that?
Well, a couple things. One, obviously, is that the Amish have large families. Most families have six or seven children on average. Some families even have many more than that. But it's not just the large number of children. It's an increasing, we would say, retention rate. That is, an increasing percentage of the children of Amish parents choose to join the Amish church and follow the Amish way of life as adults. In the mid-20th century, perhaps 60% of Amish children chose to follow the Amish way of life as adults themselves. And today, it's about 85 or 90% of Amish children who do. And some of the reasons behind that, I think, include the rise of Amish schools, which is mostly a phenomenon of the second half of the 20th century. The first Amish school in Michigan started in 1956, and today almost all Amish children across the country attend Amish schools rather than public schools. So there's that kind of early formation and influence of Amish schools. And I think another one of the reasons actually has to do, and this surprises some people, but I think it has to do with change in the Amish community, particularly economic change. In the mid-20th century, it was really necessary to be a farmer, a successful farmer, to be a real member of the Amish community. And in the later 20th century, changing Amish economic patterns, there are now Amish folks who have their own small businesses, maybe work for other Amish businesses or work in non-Amish businesses. In other words, there are more economic possibilities. In some ways, it's easier to be Amish economically today than it was 50 or 60 years ago.
Trudy, tell us just who are the Amish. I get the sense it's a real mistake to think of them as one great big unified group. Is there a formal definition of Amish?
There is an informal sociological definition, and usually when we're talking about the Amish, we refer to those who still drive a horse and buggy rather than own and drive an automobile. But there are many different kinds of Amish, different varieties of Amish, and they are also related to the Mennonites, who have a whole range of strictness also.
One of the things that makes it challenging to generalize about the Amish is that as a church, and maybe we should clarify that, to be Amish is to be a member of the Amish church. There certainly are ethnic group components to the Amish experience, but it does at the end of the day come down to being a member of the Amish church. But the Amish church is very locally organized. There are no synods or dioceses or conferences. It doesn't parallel a lot of other denominations that many listeners may be familiar with in the Christian tradition. The 280,000 Amish people in the U.S. and Ontario comprise a little over 2,000 local Amish church groups, and each of those local churches has the authority, I guess we would say, to establish its own rules regarding technology and dress and a whole range of other issues. So it's not much of an exaggeration to say that there are actually 2,000 slightly different ways to be Amish today.
That was Steve Nold, who's a professor of history at Goshen College in Indiana, and he's co-author of the book The Amish. We're also speaking with Gertrude Enders Huntington. Trudy is a retired lecturer from the University of Michigan and co-wrote the book Amish Children, Education in the Family, School, and Community, as we look in the Amish in America and here in Michigan. And let's get into just how much the Amish reject modern technology. And Steve, you had a terrific quote in your book: had they simply rejected all things modern, they would surely have become a fossilized subculture. And we've certainly seen from what you've said that hasn't happened. How do they manage to reject modern technology all the while living in the 21st century, in many cases operating big successful businesses?
Well, most Amish communities use three different strategies all at the same time: acceptance, rejection, and modification when it comes to different sorts of technologies. And the more conservative settlements might use rejection more often than acceptance, and some of those on the more progressive end of the Amish scale might use acceptance more often than rejection. But all of them are using adaptation to some degree. Ways in which Amish families or Amish churches have chosen, for example, to draw a distinction between use and ownership, and might say, for example, well, it's fine to make use of a car. We're not going to own a car. If we own a car, then that gives us That gives us the ultimate control. We have, as an automobile, the name suggests, automatic mobility. We can choose when we want to go, where we want to go. So we won't own a car, but we may use a car. We may hire someone to drive us someplace. Some Amish communities have said, look, we're not going to have telephones in our homes, but an Amish business might be permitted to have a business phone that's not in the home but is part of the business. Some Amish contractors and roofers have cell phones that they use because when they're out on the job site, they need to be talking with subcontractors. Then there are some other very conservative Amish communities that they wouldn't be making those adaptations. They wouldn't have a telephone connection of any sort, for example, and they would be very slow to hire a driver to take them someplace. But in all of these communities, the question of what are we going to accept, what are we going to reject, and what are we going to adapt is an ongoing and lively conversation. There really aren't things that are you know, completely off limits for discussion. These things are things that are continually being discussed and weighed.
Trudy, do we see, or as you study these Amish communities, if a family's uncomfortable with maybe the more progressive approach their community takes, do you see people picking up stakes and moving to one that perhaps is more conservative? Do you see that much?
Yes, that certainly does happen. They move both ways. Some move to more conservative ones, and some families move to more liberal Amish communities, depending on what they're interested in, what they believe in, and what they're willing to accept or put up with. I mean, there's been whole communities in Michigan, in southern Michigan, that moved away because they didn't want to be influenced by some of the more wild groups in northern Indiana, and they didn't want their young people. They wanted their young people to be more isolated.
Okay, those wild groups in Indiana. What about that? You know, and that leads me to want to talk about the education of children in the Amish community. And I want to double back to that question that I posed at the beginning of our conversation. How do you get such successful entrepreneurs out of schools that go only to the eighth grade and they don't have any of that technology that the rest of us considers imperative to a good education? Trudy, what did you find as you researched your book?
Well, I found that the Amish are extremely adaptable. People think they're ossified peasants, but they're not. They're very adaptable. And a lot of them are very good with machines, and they're fascinated by things like cell phones and computers, and they do go to libraries. So they often do learn how to manage even things like the computers, which they can't have in their home, but they're not forbidden to use in a place, most of them in a place like the library. Again, it's hard to generalize because there's such a range as to what they allow and what they don't allow. So it depends on which ones you talk to. But children in the Amish schools learn hard work. They learn to be diligent. And they also, I think, get a kind of confidence that they can try anything, even though they supposedly end their education in eighth grade. The attitude is that you keep on learning. That gives you the basis from which you can go and learn the specialty that you need or want.
Yeah, I think that's really one of the key features is that schooling may end with eighth grade, but education certainly doesn't end with eighth grade. And the what we might talk about in formal terms as an apprenticeship, although the Amish don't really set them up as formal apprenticeships. But the idea that when one finishes eighth grade, you go to work in a family business, family farm, a neighbor's business, and Amish teens at age 17, 18 have a lot of responsibility, in some cases responsibilities for ordering supplies, negotiating contracts, making sure there's delivery of finished goods, sorts of things that many people, you know, in wider society don't have those opportunities until they are in middle management type settings when they're in their 30s or 40s.
Talk to us about what happens to the Amish boy or girl who wants to think of more formal education, even college. Is that at all accepted in the community, or does that pose problems?
It poses problems. On occasion, it's been permitted, but it has not really worked out. However, they do take correspondence courses, and in many communities, or in some communities, they take the GED, so that they can work in factories.
I think one of the ways maybe to think about this is, do children in Amish homes ever go to high school or college? Occasionally they do. I think it's safe to say that if you are a 15-year-old and want to go to high school, if you're already thinking that differently than your parents at that age, there's really a very slim chance that you are interested in an Amish way of life as an adult. So the handful of Amish teens who go to high school or go to college are I think sort of destined not to be adult members of the Amish community. I mean, it's a bit like saying, you know, I want to live in North Dakota and I want to be a marine biologist. And at a certain point, you know, you're going to have to make a choice between one or the other of those things.
And one thing we should make clear, am I correct that children make a decision once they're adults whether they want to remain in the community?
That's right. The Amish Church practices baptism of adults, so you become a member of the Amish Church through baptism, but it's not the baptism of infants or even young children. Baptism is something that generally happens at the individual's discretion between the ages of usually 18 and 20, sometimes a bit earlier or a bit later, but generally the late teens. And so that's the point at which one would actually become a member of the Amish Church.
And do some of these young people take some time out, what the English might call a gap year, try life outside of the constraints of the Amish community?
Well, there are two authorities in Amish society, the family and the church. And in traditional rural society, often when one reached the age of 16, one came out somewhat from under the authority of the parents, had more free time, discretionary time, were able to maybe retain some of their wages if they were working away from home. So you do have this liminal space in the late teen years where children are no longer completely under the authority of their parents, and they have not yet, in most cases, joined the church and come under the authority of the church. So there is this period of time in which those in their late teens are living a bit between family and church, and so they're able to do some things that when they were younger their parents wouldn't let them do, and when they get older and join the church they're not going to be able to do. And that range of activity also again varies quite a bit from community to community. Some of the things that Amish young people in that stage of life are doing might seem to the rest of us to be quite tame, like going to the mall or going to the movie theater. In other cases, it includes may include some fairly deviant behavior, underage drinking, buying a car, reckless driving. So there really are a range of things. It's not the case, though, that every Amish person you know, between the ages of 16 and 18 just goes wild by any means, although there have been some television documentaries that unfortunately give that impression. But it is the case across the board that there is this period of time in the teens when children in Amish homes are somewhat betwixt and between the two major authorities in their lives.
Finally, I'd like your thoughts, Trudy, as you began your study in your grad work in the 1950s, you were talking to me about how the public was very much against and they were very resistant to the Amish for a myriad of reasons. But today the public is very entranced by all things Amish, even as branding. That's something that it's got a lure. What is it about the Amish, do you think, that has us so entranced and interested in them today?
I think there are many things. I think one thing is their family life, the fact that they do hold on to their children. But I think also we imagine them as our grandparents or as living an ideal life. And there's such an emphasis on individualism in our contemporary culture that I think we are nostalgic about the importance of community and social responsibility, which, of course, the Amish feel very strongly, and they're very supportive of one another. And I think that's something else that appeals to us.
That was Gertrude Enders Huntington, retired lecturer from the University of Michigan and the co-author of Amish Children, Education in the Family, School, and Community. She spoke to us from her home in Kennett Square, Pennsylvania. And we've also been speaking with Steve Nold, who's a professor of history at Goshen College in Indiana. He also co-wrote The Amish, which was the companion book to the American Experience documentary on PBS. You've both given us new insights, and thank you so much for your time and for sharing with us.
You're very welcome.
Thank you.
Still to come, there has been lots of talk and plenty of controversy about what will happen to the assets of the Detroit Institute of Arts. The clamor has continued now with the news that Christie's Auction House is formally appraising works of the DIA. We find out more in 10 minutes. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. The eyes of the art world are trained on the Detroit Institute of Arts. Christie's Auction House is formally appraising the city-owned works of the DIA at the request of emergency manager Kevin Orr. The very hint of the idea that pieces in the DIA collection could be sold off to satisfy Detroit's creditors has had the impact of a tsunami in the art world. The DIA says the collection belongs to the public, and thus it's protected by a public trust. And as we mentioned earlier with Sarah Swick, these are all questions federal judge Stephen Rhodes will eventually decide. So now with this appraisal, there is this for the art world and art patrons to consider. When Christie's delivers its report to Orr, it will be the first time the public gets an idea of the market value of thousands of pieces of art in a world-class museum. Joining us to talk about what this means for the DIA, the City of Detroit, and for the art world, we welcome Detroit Free Press staff writer Mark Stryker. Your piece in this week's Free Press included a quote that really jumped out at me from the director of the Dallas Museum of Art, and his quote was, "This is like the weighing of souls. This is biblical stuff." Just how significant in the art world is this appraisal?
Well, it's essentially never happened before, so we would have to say it's unprecedented. Major museums do not have their works appraised in this way. There are insurance appraisals that happen, which are very different kinds of things than the notion of much more informal than these kinds of formal appraisals that an auction house would do, as if you were going to put the works up for sale, as indeed these might be. So, you know, we have a general idea about what many of the treasures in some museums might be worth on the market, but no one has sort of wrapped up this many works in this kind of a public forum. And because these appraisals will be made public through the bankruptcy process, we're going to have a window into the worth of these works in a major American museum, unlike we have in any other situation.
Help us understand, for those of us who don't really know the workings of an art museum, why do they not do formal appraisals like this? How does it differ from the insurance appraisals?
Well, they don't do these kinds of appraisals because they don't sell work on a regular basis. You know, when they do appraisals, they are done for insurance purposes, and those are done by, you know, a curator, the registrar at the museum. They'll look at works, they'll sort of eyeball them, they'll do sketchy kind of research to see what they might be worth. But because museums don't necessarily insure works, insure individual works, they have blanket kinds of coverage, and no museum could afford to insure all of the works at replacement value in their collection. They simply don't do these because it's not relevant to what they do. They don't have to report the value of their collection on their balance sheets as assets for federal accounting rules. So it's just not something that is part of the daily life of a museum. A formal appraisal like Christie's will do is, it's much deeper. One looks at quality and historical significance and provenance and most importantly, comparable sales at other public auctions and knowledge of the private art market when works are sold between dealers or between private clients, collectors and dealers. And all of that stuff goes into creating what we would think of as a formal appraisal of a work of art.
So it's really a deep dive. And roughly how many pieces do you think the DIA is going to have appraised?
Well, what the agreement between the emergency manager's office and Christie's calls for up to 3,500 works that could be appraised. And these are the works that were bought directly by the city of Detroit, most of them between 1920 and 1930 when the city was flush with cash. And these are works that include many of the greatest treasures in the museum, the Van Gogh self-portrait, the great Bruegel, the wedding dance, Matisse's The Window, Rembrandt's pieces by Rembrandt and Bellini and others that are real icons of the museum.
When you talked with experts in the art world, based on their knowledge of these pieces that are at the DIA, what kind of ballpark figure did you get that possibly could be the value of the museum's collection?
Well, a couple of months ago, I spoke with some dealers and did some of my own research looking at auction records and the like. And the values on some of these works is absolutely staggering. We're talking about, you know, $50 million to $150 million perhaps for some of these works. When you start talking about things like Matisse's The Window, you know, extraordinarily beautiful, historically important and desirable work, we're talking about $150 million perhaps. Bruegel's The Wedding Dance, we're talking about $100 million or more. The Van Gogh self-portrait, I think the figure we got was $60 million. So it's a lot of money. It's a lot of money. Now, it's important to point out that, you know, when a work like these go up for auction, you never really know exactly what they're going to sell for because it's very difficult to get comparable on some of these works, because works of this quality and historical significance simply do not come on the market.
Sure.
I mean, it's been forever that a Bruegel like this would have been offered for sale. So on some level, there are no comparables. So you're sort of guessing, and kind of depends on who shows up at the auction and who's highly motivated. Works could sell for much more than the estimates, or frankly, they could sell for less. So you never sort of really know. I do want to go back for a moment, though, and you asked a moment ago about how many works would be up for, how many works they're going to appraise. And of those 3,500 works that we talked about that are bought directly by the city of Detroit, about 300 of them are currently on view as part of the museum's permanent display. So we're talking about several hundred of what the museum considers its greatest treasures.
And what doors do you think this appraisal, once this is out there and this report is public and people can open that up and learn information that, as you write, generally art museums treat this information like state secrets, what doors do you think this appraisal opens that'll change the way that the public regards the DIA?
Well, I think the fear at the DIA and its supporters is that it makes it easier to think about the work in terms of purely monetary value. And because of that, it makes it easier to think about the works as assets that one could sell to help settle the debt in Detroit. And it takes art from the notion of what its real value is, which is this notion of the transcendent value of art and what it means to a community and to an individual and to human imagination and all of these things that, you know, really create the enduring value of a piece of art. And it sets those aside solely for the monetary market value. And it shapes the way, helps reshape the way we think about works that are held in public museums. And indeed, throughout the country, there are directors of museums and people who think a lot about the art world that are concerned that, you know, any move on the art in Detroit would be a move against art in museums everywhere, because all museums have trustees that oftentimes look at the workings of a museum just in terms of the balance sheet, and they think about selling works all the time to replenish operational funds, or if there are deficits, well, why don't we just sell a work or two? Well, the fact is, you know, in the museum world, the ethics of the museum world, the controlling industry standards say that one only can sell works to and one can only take the money that's used from selling a work of art to buy other works of art. And one can only sell works that are either inferior quality or no longer fit the mission of the institution. And, you know, there are very prescribed reasons why one can sell a work of art. So the fear, the great fear, is that by looking at the work only through the lens of what it's worth in the marketplace, you debase the value of what the work is really about.
So, Mark, what should we watch for? What will come next?
Well, in terms of the Christie's appraisal, we know that they should be done with their work over the next couple of months, and we should have some sort of answer about what the art is worth by October, late October, early November. And the emergency manager, Kevin Orr, has said that he wants to have a plan of reorganization in place by the end of the year. So, you know, by the end of the year, we would know whether or not the art would be on the table or not. But there is going to be sort of a behind-the-scenes fight going on all along between the creditors who want to see the art put on the table because they want more money on the dollar than Orr is currently offering. And Orr, at this point, has said he doesn't want to sell art, and it's not part of his plan. You know, in Chapter 9, neither a judge nor creditors can force the sale of any asset, but creditors can object to Orr if they think the city is shielding legitimate sources of cash and urge the judge to refuse approval. So if a judge agrees, he can put pressure on Orr to put the art on the table. And, you know, then we're in a big legal fight. It's unclear who would hold the upper hand. The Attorney General of the state of Michigan has said that art cannot be sold from the museum because it's held in the public trust, but it's unclear if the Attorney General's formal opinion would hold weight in a bankruptcy court. So there's a struggle going on, and we'll just kind of have to watch to see if parts of that sort of come out in the public.
Detroit Free Press staff writer Mark Stryker, thanks so much for talking with us on the program today, Mark.
You're welcome.
So let's broaden out and look at the overall Detroit bankruptcy and this fundamental issue. Does Detroit qualify for bankruptcy protection? That's the question Judge Stephen Rhodes of Federal Bankruptcy Court will have to decide later this fall. Monday was the last day for creditors, unions, and retirees to file their formal challenges to Detroit's eligibility for bankruptcy protection. Well, now that that deadline has come and gone, we wanted to get an idea who objected, why, and find out what happens next. Michigan Radio's Sarah Swick joins us now. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Cindy. Glad to be here.
Yes, good to have you on the program. Well, creditors, and there are others, saying that the city did not truly negotiate with them. What is that about?
Well, one of the requirements of Chapter 9 municipal bankruptcy is that the city or the municipality is supposed to bargain in good faith with the various creditors to try to reach an agreement before actually filing for bankruptcy. And what a number of the groups who objected and individuals are saying is that Kevin Orr didn't truly do that. I've heard stories from several people and several groups saying essentially we were sort of herded into a room and given a PowerPoint presentation about this is what the city is offering, and there was never really any bargaining done whatsoever. So they're challenging Detroit's eligibility for bankruptcy on those grounds.
And their hope would be to...
Well, their hope would be that I think what would happen would be that the filing would be would not be deemed eligible, and then at that point they would sort of have, I think, go back and start bargaining again, and they would hope that that this time they would be able to, from their viewpoint, get a better deal than maybe what Kevin Orr was offering before he filed for bankruptcy.
Okay, and I saw somewhere about since 1954, only 29 of 62 municipal bankruptcies in the U.S. have been dismissed. So one might think that the odds are not in their favor.
Not in their favor. I mean, another one of the litmus tests for being eligible for Chapter 9 is that the city truly has to be insolvent. In this case, that doesn't seem to be much in dispute, although some of the objections filed by some of the creditors did bring up that they thought the city wasn't truly insolvent. But in this case, Detroit clearly is financially strapped. I think the issue of the good faith bargaining and the issue of, which we haven't discussed yet, about the constitutional protections for pensions are probably going to be the bigger issues that are going to be discussed in court.
Do I get the sense that that second issue you brought up, the constitutional protection of pensions, that's really going to be really Pandora's box, if you will, once that's opened?
Absolutely. I really think so, because people all over the country are definitely looking closely at whether Detroit is going to be able to get out from under its pension obligations, and also sort of, you know, for legal scholars among us, this whole idea of whether going into bankruptcy court, federal law trumps the state constitution. So I think that is something that people are watching very, very closely, for sure.
Now, I'm sure the big players, the names that we've heard, AFSCME, AFL-CIO, some of these large groups certainly were there to file their objections. What about individuals, the folks who are just scared to death they're going to lose their pensions and they're going to wind up having to pay more for health care? Were there many of those individuals filing objections yesterday?
Well, there have been some individuals, retirees I know of, who objected, had already filed objections just on their own behalf, you know, obviously concerned about their pensions for the most part. I also ran into a group of people who are just everyday Detroiters who apparently received notices in the mail just this past week from the federal court saying, you know, as a resident or business owner in the city of Detroit, you are an interested party in this case and can file an objection. And some people were saying, well, we didn't have enough time, we didn't know about that. So they were sort of had like a pre-written formal objection that people were filing based on several different grounds, but one of them being that they didn't have enough time to know ahead of time to really prepare a real objection. But from what I understand, and I haven't gone through all of the court filings, but the unions and the retirees and the various individuals, and I think overall there are about 100 separate objections that came in, but the larger creditors, or at least I'm talking about bond insurers and banks, didn't so much challenge the eligibility at this point. Apparently that's their challenge to what Kevin Orr is proposing is going to come later on down the line when he proposes a plan of adjustment, which is basically here's how the city's going to cut their debt. And at that point, that's probably when they're going to, you know, try and wrangle out a better deal for themselves.
So now that Judge Rhodes' objection deadline has passed, what comes next?
What comes next is there's going to be there's a couple deadlines coming up, a sort of flurry of discovery, you know, hearings and things that are going to have to happen. But the big next big date would be October 23rd, I believe, which is the date that Judge Rhodes has set for an eligibility trial, which is when all this is going to really get fought out in court and the eligibility issue will be decided. Now, it's important to remember that Judge Rhodes has also appointed a mediator here, so there's behind-the-scenes action going on in terms of, you know, the real nitty-gritty of continuing negotiations is going on behind the scenes, and Judge Rhodes has made it pretty clear we want to keep our sessions in court confined to the pretty the big legal issues.
And things are, in terms of a legal pace, they're moving fairly quickly, aren't they?
From what I understand, from people who have, observed the, handful of bankruptcy cases, municipal bankruptcy cases that even come close to what Detroit is going through, say, yeah, that this is a pretty aggressive timeline and that they're moving pretty quickly. And the city, or the lawyers for the city, say they want to file their plan of adjustment by the end of the year, which is even earlier than the deadline the judge had set. So they clearly want to move really fast.
Michigan Radio's Sarah Swick checking in from Detroit with the latest on the bankruptcy issue. Thank you so much, Sarah.
Thank you.
And we would love to get your thoughts on what we've talked about with the Detroit bankruptcy, with the DIA appraisals. You can find us online at michiganradio.org and click on the link that says Stateside. Go to Facebook and search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty. And we're on Twitter at Stateside Radio. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Peg Watson. Contributors are Ellie Billings, Emily Fox, Mercedes Mejia, Katie Suha, and April Van Buren. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening, and let's talk tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock.